Is it time? It's time? Doomsday time? 2 minutes. 1, 2, 3, 4. I was an ant last day. I know why.
Because you told them all they didn't have class, right?
So,
you know this is all the Wednesday class people.
We're a little bit thin.
This is all the Wednesday people.
Probably the Monday people still having a migraines. But anyway.
Oh no.
So we won't talk about what happened Monday yet. We're going to wait until the Wednesday group gets the same wonderful experience that you all had at Monday group. And then we'll chit-chat about things on Thursday a little bit. So what? And remember, next week, we do have class on Thursday. In case you had your exam on Wednesday and you think you have no class the next day. But there is a class on Thursday. And then the following week, because some reason they're not having the regular, you know, research lab experience, but we're going to use a lab time, right? Because we're dedicated physiologists. And we're going to go to the lab, meet in the lab first, go over your exam for your section, because every section has a different exam, right? So we'll go over your exam. I'll have them all graded. I graded some section already. We won't go into that yet. And then we're going to go over your exam in that class, make sure we understand the answers. And then we're going to do some activities. And then we're going to go over to the outreach center and play with some human tissues and things, which then fits with the other content that we're going to be covering in the rest of the class. Okay, so it all actually works. But so next week, we do have lab. We do go to your regular sections, but you're not going to have a test like you had this week, right? So breathe easy. But it is a part of a content that you want to know about, right, and learn for the next exams. All right, so we can't just not pay attention to it. Okay, so I think I mentioned this book. I just wanted to show it to you. It's really quite cool, Brain on Fire. We talked about that, right? Anybody remember what the main problem was? Antibodies to glutamate receptors, a particular type. NMDA receptors, right. So this is a really good book if you want something outside the box to read. It's really fun. You can get it cheap on Amazon Prime or something. All right, so that's one thing. So I didn't get to finish the part on synaptic transmission yet because we're saving that because Wednesday still has their test, so I don't want to cover some of that content, but we're going to come back to that. But right now we're going to move on to sensory systems, and it doesn't matter which textbook you're using, Eckert or the other one or whatever you're using. You know, you can look up stuff on Wikipedia. But if you're using a textbook, any physiology textbook, just go to the sensory chapter, and pretty much it's the same content, the general content. But some people were using a human physiology textbook. That's okay, too, but then you're going to pay a little bit more attention in class because we cover it in a comparative aspect, right? But some of the fundamental mechanisms are the same. Before we get into the sensory system, it is so cool. I mean, we did have a course on sensory systems, and I taught it like 3 years ago, but we're just kind of saturated and we don't have enough faculty to teach all these courses. But it was really neat. We had a whole course on sensory systems, and you can just imagine there are courses out there in the world that just cover a whole course on the ear, you know, a whole course just on the eye, right? So it's that detailed and that interesting. But we're going to have kind of an overview, right? But when you think about sensory systems, you have to just stop and think. It's amazing, right? How is it that you sense temperature right here? How is it that you sense, you know, the touch on your skin? How is it that you know where your limbs are moving without looking at them, right? You can scratch the back of your head. If everybody closes their eyes for a second, you touch your two fingers together. Can you do that? Is everybody able to do that? If you close your eyes, you touch your two fingers together. And you do it one time, and the second time you do it a lot better. Anybody that can't do that? We need to schedule a neurology appointment. Okay. But some people can't do that, actually, because they might have their corpus callosum not developed right. Or, actually, in some epileptics, they actually cut the corpus callosum. That's the region that connects the two parts of the brain together. So they actually do that to keep the spread down. But if you can't do that, we need to go get checked out. Okay. So it's interesting when you think about sensory perception, all kinds of things. So what else about sensory perception? What's kind of interesting out there to you that's just odd, do you think? Anybody? And we don't think about it. We take it for granted all the time, right? You ever hear anybody say they feel really cold, but the next person doesn't, right? You wonder why, right? Is it just because maybe they're more sensitive? Is there something about that? Is it, you know, central? Is it they just not paying attention to it? What is it, you know, in that sense, right? And then you think about some people aren't very coordinated, right? They walk, they stumble. Is there something wrong with their proprioception? You know, the number one risk over in the hospital is really fall risk, right? People in the hospital that fall, and they worry about that because the legal suits and things like that. But you wonder, why do they have a fall risk? Is it because their proprioceptors are off after surgery, for example? The anesthetic's still in there? Is it sepsis? Is it something else going on? Is it the drugs that they're taking? Is it an equilibrium problem? You know, high antibiotics can destroy your hearing, right? And people wonder, why is that? What's the mechanism behind that? Anybody ever hear anything about that? No? High antibiotics? It used to be a big problem a long time ago. Back in the 70s, you used to treat really kids with acne with high tetracycline, for example. And then they started losing their hearing, so they kind of dampened that down. But kids had permanent hearing loss from some of that. So that's not good either. And then, you know, it did cause staining of the teeth, too, if you're taking it during development and you can't get rid of it afterwards. So lots of interesting things out there that you think of what we've learned from drugs and mistakes that happen. But then you think about your sensory system. It's phenomenal. Your vision, right? A million neurons in your one optic nerve going into your brain on one side and the other side. And then you wonder, how is your eye, you know, working to see color or contrast? That's what's so amazing about the sensory system. But think about also behavior, right? Your behavior is related to your sensory system, how you perceive your environment around you. And then if anybody's interested in business or psychology or really hitting behavioral psychology, you've probably maybe covered it, but you know, their business courses, these people that make, you know, million-dollar business deals, do you think they're worried about sensory perception? What do you think they do differently if they walk and they're going to have a business meeting? Did you cover this in psychology or some general course? Anybody? What do you think? You're going to go into a business deal. You're coming into a room with a bunch of business people, CEOs of a company. You're going to make a $1 million contract, right? What kind of environment do you want?
Happy.
Happiness.
Open.
Pardon?
Open.
Open, kind of, right?
Professional.
Pardon?
Professional.
Professional, right? So how do you portray that? By your dress and
posture,
attitude. Where are we going with this? It's all sensory perception, right? It's all sensory perception by the people around you. So I'm not good at it and I don't pay attention to it, as you can imagine. But people do worry about it. How about anybody working in a pediatric or volunteering in a pediatric ward? Yeah. What color are the walls?
Colorful.
Pardon?
The pediatric?
Yeah. Colorful, usually pastel colors,
yeah,
right?
Like, yeah, you can take your children there, like, they have it with all the, like, animals and the, under the sea and jungle.
Animals, under the sea, jungle. But they're not going to use a bright red, probably, you know, all over the room, or bright yellow, right? So why do you think that is? Innate behavior that you have to those colors. So if somebody walks in a room, still-faced, you know, not happy, not, you know, just shining your teeth or something is really kind of changes the mood. But if you walk in a room with a red shirt, pretty much, you've already set, what, an aggressive response. You've already have an autonomic response. Your audience already has an autonomic response of a, kind of a fear. It's just natural. Come in pastel colors, it's different. If you smile, for example, it can change the whole attitude of the other person. They know this with children and babies. If you take a newborn baby or, you know, baby that's an infant, and the mother's smiling at it, or somebody else is just smiling and saying, "You're the ugliest little thing." No, I'm joking. But as long as you're smiling and saying it, they respond back with a smile. And they've even done this with other primates, monkeys, for example, and chimps. If they actually show the face of a picture, not the real one, but a picture of the mother smiling, the baby chimp is actually happier. But if they show one with a fear response, the baby's already, you know, crying and kind of screaming and retracting. Isn't that amazing? So a facial expression, how much that can change your audience, right? So now think about those people making that $1 million deal. Where do they want? Do they want to be in charge of it? Are they going to be aggressive? Are they going to be passive? Are they waiting? Do they have facial expressions? That sets the tone. If you do your interviews, if some of you are interested in med school interviews and things, what kind of tone do you want? Things to think about. Because sensory perception is a big thing, right? It can change the attitude, and that initial interaction can really be make or break things. So just think about that future in life and things like that, too. So that's really the case, because they've looked at that in many animals, and it's a kind of a autonomic response in us and primates that they've looked at. And you can imagine even dogs. You might have a pet dog, right? You walk your dog, and some dogs have like their teeth are just showing, right, when they're walking, and that already causes another dog to kind of have a fear response, and they'll attack. But sometimes, you know, the dog is just, you know, without showing their teeth, and then they don't have that same response. So it's really quite interesting, you know, all the way for simpler interactions as well. So think about behavior. It's really quite cool. And then when you think about behavior in the natural environment, you've had ecology, most of you've had ecology, right? No? Some of you have, some of you haven't. Do you remember talking about a particular behavior in the natural environment? What do they call that? If you're going to study that? Was there something about that? I know, cobwebs up there. Did you study about Conrad Lorenz, Nikki Tinbergen, Conrad Frisch? No?
Fixed action.
Kind of fixed action patterns, some other things. Imprinting, right? Conrad Lorenz.
These are fantastic people.
Fantastic people. So you want to look up their stuff. It's really cool. Oops. Okay, so these guys, ethology is a study of animal behavior in a natural environment. Ethology. So we should cover that somewhere in ecology classes. These guys got the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine for studying animal behavior, basically, and understanding how they react in their environment. So, Carl Van Frisch, his work is actually studying the bees, the bee dance. Everybody knows about bee dance, pretty much. The honeybee comes and does the bee dance and then tells the rest of the hive where to go to get the bees and the honey, right, or the nectar. So he actually studied this bee dance, and he was from Graz, Austria. And about, oh gosh, maybe 15 years ago, I was giving a seminar in Graz, Austria, and they actually have a endowed chair for Carl Van Frisch. What's so neat about Graz, Austria, when you're there, the student center sells t-shirts, and a lot of students wear them around faculty and have all these posters. They sell a t-shirt with these different pictures on them. And I think there were 7 Nobel laureates from Graz, University of Graz. So, I mean, it's really something else. Conrad Lorenz, you've probably heard of his work, but maybe you forgot what he did. Imprinting, basically the gray lag geese. So he showed when the geese are born, they will imprint on whatever they're following, like the mother. So he could actually take away the mother, and then the little babies would actually follow him, right? And so he studied that, but he also studied wild boars and their behavior as well. And so that's pretty neat. He was from Austria, right outside of Salzburg. I had a great ecology teacher when I was an undergraduate at Texas Tech, and he went to study at Conrad Lorenz Institute, and I was traveling around, and he said, why don't you drop by? And so he went to find this little village somewhere where they were actually had him studying birds. That's pretty neat. Conrad Lorenz's place. They happened to kill a boar that night. It was one of their research boars, and we had wild boar meat, so that was pretty cool. Nicholas Tinbergen, anybody know what he did?
Didn't he do the gulls and displacement of the nest?
Yeah, gulls, and he also did digger wasp. Really a phenomenal guy. One of his students was Richard Dawkins. But Nicholas Tinbergen, he was an undergraduate student, so it's just amazing. You know, you think about science like we've talked about in the past. So he was studying these digger wasps in the beach area in the Netherlands, or Den Haag area. And he was wondering, how can this little digger wasp come out of the sand, because they burrowed in the sand, fly up and fly down the beach, go get whatever they need to do, and then come back and find that little hole on that big beach, right? Sand everywhere. how is it that they could know where that is? So he wanted to study that. And as an undergraduate, he then went to graduate school, and he said, I want to study this for my graduate work. And the faculty all said, no, that's not a very good idea. We don't want to do that. And he was really upset by that. So he actually did his work, published it. Conrad Lorenz caught on to it and said, hey, this is really neat stuff. And so they said, oh, maybe you should come back to graduate school and study this stuff. So he actually got the Nobel Prize and shared it with them. What he found out is that the digger wasp comes out of that little hole and then flies around and keeps hovering and hovering and hovering and then flies off. So he noticed that. What he did was then put the little rocks around the hole or the little bush, and he would move it, move that whole scene to another spot. So when the wasp came back, he realized it was memorizing that pattern and would try to find that hole even though he moved it far away from where it originally was. So they had a spatial memory. So you think a little digger wasp, a spatial memory, that little brain, how do they do that, right? Sometimes we might have a problem just finding where we remember where we left our keys, right? So you think about the wasp, if it can't find that, it can't find the nest, and the little ones are maybe not getting their food. So it's really interesting. These three then got the Nobel Prize for their work for studying animal behavior in their natural environment. So that's ethology. Then people started to break that up. And so then there's a group called neuroethologists that just study it, how the brain works with this. And so one of the American fathers of neuroethology, we'll talk about that in a minute, but here's oops. I can put that up there. There we go. So Conrad Lorenz has written really phenomenal books for the general public, not detailed, but just really fun reading books. So one of them is King Solomon's Ring. It's really neat, about natural environment. You might want to get that. That's over at the library. But the other book of Vincent Detier here. I'm not testing you on names. Don't worry about that. But he wrote a book, To Know a Fly. Really simple understanding the housefly. So how does a housefly find food? How does a housefly, you see them, they can land upside down on the ceiling, right? How do they do that? Got little suction cups, or what do they do? You know, how do they land? How do they take off upside down? So he wanted to study just a simple thing. So he wrote this book that's really neat, To Know a Fly, just generally understanding how flies function and the basic biology of them that we just take for granted. So he wondered, you know, they can't fly in the dark, regular housefly, they don't fly. And so he actually set up activity grams to watch, you know, flies fly, like see if they had a pattern, circadian pattern or not. In the dark, they won't fly. They can walk around, but they won't fly because they need to see. So that's kind of neat. That'd be neat. Knock out all the flies, just, you know, churn out the lights, right? But he actually did some really neat things in his book that he wrote about. He didn't see his activity gram where he should have on a certain day. And he was wondering, how come the activity didn't go up that day when it should have at this time? And so he traced it down and then found out, well, he asked the janitor, you always come in at this time, 7 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, I always get my flies to respond when the lights are on and you leave them on. But that one day, they never had any activity until later in the day, like 11. And the janitor said, no, I was there at 7, you know. He said, well, so look at my activity gram. So we actually caught the janitor, not, you know, then finally he admitted that he didn't come in until 11. But anyways, you see the flies caught him. But he's written some really nice books. His daughter, his granddaughter, actually helps fund undergraduate students to go to Friday Harbor Marine Lab for the summer. So if you're looking up at internships and you're looking at Friday Harbor neurobiology courses or an animal behavior course, my own grad student actually got some funding from his granddaughter to actually help pay her way and her stay while she was at a marine lab up at Friday Harbor. It's a marine lab off the University of Washington in Puget Sound. So pretty neat if you get a book like that. That's a really neat one. And some other things about behavior. When you think about then clinical aspects of behavior. Anybody hear of Oliver Sacks? Phenomenal guy, Oliver Sacks. He died this last year. He was up at in New York. And anybody remember the movie Robin Williams, Awakening? You know Robin Williams? It's really good. Too bad he had depression and died. Yeah. Or L-Dopa. Right. So The Awakening, if you haven't seen that movie, you should get it on Netflix or something, or however you get it. So he was, he's a neurologist. So Robin Williams played his role in the movie Awakening. The Awakening, what he did, and he was actually fired from Mount Sinai Hospital in New York because of his craziness that he did. But he actually fed patients L-DOPA, and they were Parkinson's patients, basically. And they kind of woke up. Their brain was basically not functioning. And it's really neat. I'll give away the end of the movie from this, but still, the movie's good to watch. So he was actually treating them, and they were awakening. All of a sudden, they would, like, I thought it was back in, you know, the 1950s, and now it's, what, you know, 1990? It's crazy, right? And so they began to understand these people were lacking dopamine. And then the Parkinson's being treated. So he started that off. What he also realized, if he gave them too much, at the end of the movie, it's kind of funny because you see all these older people fighting with each other. You realize that too much of it caused psychosis. So from his studies, his clinical studies on people, they really broke the field in understanding what L-DOPA can do. And the dopamine being too high or too low in people can really change their whole behavior. So this fits with sensory perception, too, because you perceive things and you're not integrating it right. So then, anybody know what the problem is with L-DOPA treatments over time, like with Parkinson's patients? You know, they can treat Parkinson's, right, give L-DOPA, but... Yeah, they desensitize to it, so they keep giving it, and they give a little bit more. They change a lot of the treatments to just give enough so they don't have the shaking. But if they give too much, then they desensitize even sooner to it. So that was a big problem. So now they give some other drugs too that decrease the breakdown of dopamine also. So that's kind of neat. Anybody ever hear of some other therapy besides pharmacological therapy for Parkinson's patients?
They have a lot of drugs that target the blood-brain barrier. That inside the tension micro, you can't. That's what has the dopaminergic drop. So I think they're trying to like do some kind of electrical therapy in UK. So I don't know. I was reading on that, but other than that, I'm not sure.
That's true. They actually put electrodes into that part of the brain and stimulate, because this neuron that's releasing dopamine, it doesn't release dopamine anymore. But the target cell still has receptors. But if you could activate those target cells by some way, what they would do is put an electrode in that part of the brain and stimulate electrically shocks. What's some of the newer therapies that they're thinking about with that instead of electrodes? Anybody hear of anything? Has to do with fiber optics. Big news? Nothing? Somebody's probably going to get a Nobel Prize. It's not going to be us, but anyways. Optogenetics. So what they're doing now is optogenetic treatments. So the problem is you have to get that neuron that would be sensitive. Instead of having a metal electrode, which they do over here across the street, metal electrodes in people's brains and stimulate it, they actually inject a virus in that part of the brain that makes a channel the opposite. It's a channel from blue-green algae. Isn't that wild? From blue-green algae, you take the DNA out of blue-green algae, you get into a virus, you inject that virus into that part of the brain, that virus then infects neurons, expresses that protein, and now it expresses the channel rhodopsin molecule. It's sensitive to blue light. There's all different types of opsins, but this particular one that they're working with is a channel rhodopsin sensitive to blue light. So now you can take a fiber optic as thin as your hair, but the problem is it's too thin, so they have to actually try to get it thicker. So they put like a needle in there, thread in the fiber optic, and then pull out the needle, and now you have a fiber optic in there. They're not doing it in humans yet, but they've done this in mice and rodent models, and the treatment is great for it. So just think about where we're going from, you know, knowing the science, taking from blue-green algae, you have to know getting that DNA out, getting in the virus, knowing about viruses, knowing about how they get into the cell, how they express in the channel, and then that channel sensitivity to blue light. So now if somebody has a little, they can just maybe push a little button and have a fiber optic turn on the light or turn it off. But the problem you can imagine is how to keep that virus expressing at the right level, right? You have to keep getting viral injections. So that's what they're trying to work out in mouse models. So you understand the beauty of science working out on a comparative aspect, understanding everything from the molecular biology to virology to the physics involved of it all. You know, what wavelength of blue light? And there's lots of different opsins that they're trying to look at now. Some opsins actually inhibit neurons. They can actually drop the resting membrane potential by activating a chloride pump. You know, things like that. So it's really amazing what's going on out there. Okay, so that's the kind of treatments that are probably coming down the line for humans, right? They've already used channel optogenetics in people, in humans now, to treat some eye disorders. So it's already being approved for some use in humans. So the first study was done last year where they're actually treated this person for visual impairment by using this technology. Phenomenal. But there was some older technology that was being used in this area, just while we're on this tangent of Parkinson's. Anybody remember something else? We're going to get into it a little bit. Let me go back to that chapter, which we can't really go into yet. But the synthesis of some of your neurotransmitters, if you know the biosynthesis, that's why biochemistry is important, although you don't want to purge it all. And it, you know, I can understand. But the biosynthesis to make dopamine, if we understand how dopamine's made, it's actually through these steps, you know, going through one transmitter and actually having one enzyme to make the next step. And in doing so, actually, your adrenal gland, your adrenal medulla, that releases, I know we didn't cover it yet, but it releases epinephrine, right? In that process, it actually makes dopamine. So what they've done, and it was actually a group in Mexico, they didn't get the credit they deserved, they should have, but in Mexico, what they did is they took the adrenal medulla, which comes from neural tissue in embryology. Embryology is a great course. We don't have one. We should have one. Sometime, maybe. But in development, when your brain is growing, it actually, parts of your brain tissue migrate in your body. It makes up your dorsal root ganglions. But part of it migrates, goes down to your adrenal medulla. The inside, not the cortex, but the inside. And it makes epinephrine, a neurotransmitter, or norepinephrine, too. But in that synthetic process, it makes dopamine. So what they did in Mexico, they thought, we know about the biochemistry. We know this is neuroendocrine origin. So let's take the adrenal medulla out of that patient, take those cells, and inject it in the substantia nigra area. And guess what? It was great. The Parkinson's went away. Phenomenal. The problem with the treatments that they were doing in Mexico with the brain surgery and all that and deep in the brain structure, their patients died. So they're kind of like, oh, we can't keep doing this. But that was a long time ago. Then the Swedes took this on and actually said, well, we have some better surgery techniques that we can do. So they actually perfected it, and they were taking from these patients their own adrenal medulla, so there's no immune response, putting it in that patient's brain, and they were, Parkinson's went away. The problem was the cells didn't stay alive. And so the Parkinson's came back. But when they interviewed those patients, they said, would you do it again? They said, sure, it was great treatment. I mean, it was like a cure for Parkinson's. The problem was they couldn't maintain it. Those cells wouldn't maintain in that region. But those patients lived. So they realized, hey, this is pretty neat stuff. So where is the research now going on with that? Where do you think it is now? Instead of taking your own cells and taking just your drink, you need your adrenal glands to live, right? So you got two of them, so you can take one. Hopefully the other one keeps going. But what they were doing now is taking out, and they couldn't do it in the States, but you can do it in some other places. They can take the adrenal gland out, and they can actually culture it. They're making stem cells out of the adrenal medulla and thinking if you can get a stem cell population, then you could maybe keep injecting stem cells and get those to work. But the problem is just keeping them alive. So they're looking out new ideas to try to keep these cells alive to treat Parkinson's. That's pretty cool. Understanding the whole gamut of it, right? Doing this kind of stuff. I know that was a tangent, but you know it fits with what we're talking about. Treatments, technology, the science, and the neurobiology. So Oliver Sacks, back to Oliver Sacks. L-DOPA treatments, too much dopamine, schizophrenic, can't understand your sensory perception. You know, some people react crazy, right, with a little stress or a visual cue. Sometimes visual cues put you in an epileptic seizure from the lights, you know, flickering at a certain way or gives you a migraine. So kind of interesting, why do people perceive things differently? And psychosis going on. And if you're really into neuroscience, great stuff, right? All that Monday's class probably doesn't want to hear about neuroscience again. But anyways, Galvani Spark, it's a really cheap book. It's a history of neurophysiology and stuff. And you can get it on Amazon.com too. But it's really quite cool. All right. So enough. Whoops, I didn't. Did I? Yeah, I did. Okay. Pardon? Oh, yes, lightning and frogs, all that good stuff. Definitely. Okay, so let's get on to this chapter 5 and think about where we are. So, sensory systems. Hopefully you see that tangent fits together. We will come back to that somewhere down the line, okay? And, you know, tangents have a meaning behind them. All right. So, sensory systems. How many senses do you have? 4, 2, 3, 5, 9. Let's see. Sight, right? Hearing, 2. Smell, 3. Taste, 4.
Temperature.
Balance. Taste. Let's just think of external. Touch, right? And 6. You can read my mind. Right? No, the 6th. Okay. Then there's internal receptors, right? So you've got generally these 5 external receptors for us, you know, humans. And we think about others that we're going to be talking about that are more specific to other animals where we have a greater perception. And then interoceptors, right? You text your proprioception, right? You know what's going on. You have pain receptors inside of your GI tract, for example, too. But how do these receptors work? And that's what we're going to cover more in this chapter as well. I mean, if you touch one hair on your arm or your head and you kind of move it around, just one hair, right, you feel it. Right? Isn't that amazing? Just one hair, you can feel that, right? And that's pretty sensitive. So how is it moving that hair that you detect it? Anybody think of how is it that you move one hair and you can detect it? Receptors, but what type of receptors? Pardon? Mechanoreceptors. Is that mechanoreceptor in the tip of the hair? If you cut the hair off, is it, you know, no, right? So I just want you to kind of think about, you know, visualize it, right? Because it's really good. So in the base, right? But what is it? If you move the hair one direction or the other direction, you pretty much feel it both ways, right? So how is it that it's actually picking up the mechanical stimulus and making that neuron fire? Key words we're looking for.
Attached to like the hair follicle.
That's
like
right.
Inside the skin.
Mm-hmm. And the hair follicle, it's a nerve fiber, it's a nerve ending, sensory ending, we call that a sensory ending, acts like a dendrite in your brain, right? But what is it that's picking that up? What is the
conformational
changes of the protein that's inside of that membrane, right? Structural change. So it's a stretch activated ion channel, which are many of your receptors function. So stretch-activated ion channels. So you have then some that are super sensitive, right? Depends on where they're located. If they're on the surface of your skin, light touch, right? If they're around the hair follicle, move that, fix it up. Deeper touch, right? You can detect that depending on where it is. And then the sensitivity of it. So we're going to go through those kind of things. So this is what we talk about, transduction. This mechanical transduction to an electrical signal. Yes? That's a great example. So the stretch activated channel is that transduction process. It is a mechanoreceptor. Okay. And it's then, you think of that membrane, the bilipid membrane, right? And you have a protein in there. You push on it, and that protein can change its conformation like a voltage-gated sodium channel. Boom. Then ions can go down their driving gradient, right? Their electrochemical gradient. So that's really neat. And then you think about other types of activity. How about if I know it won't work in here right now because it's too light, but when you go home and you're trying to sleep and you can't sleep, you're just thinking about physiology all the time, I know. But when you're at home at night or in the dark, close your eyes, you know, and push on the side of your eyeball. Now, it won't work in here because it's too bright. And what do you think is going to happen? You see light, right? You actually see like a half moon, but there's no light there. Right? So what have you done? There's no light. That's right. You've activated those receptors by that mechanical force, and it kind of deformed them. But they're not really, they're not supposed to be, you know, mechanoreceptors inside your retina to see light. But you could falsely activate them, right? So somebody, and we do this, I'll try to do this next week when we have labs with cold and warm but it depends on where we are to do this. But we'll give it a shot. You can actually, what if you took an electrical stimulation, and let's say you found the cold nerve, you know, the little sensory ending, and you electrically stimulate it. What's your perception? Cold, right? But it's not cold, right? It's the same thing we talked about before about capsaicin, right? You could rub capsaicin, the hot pepper, on your skin, and also you perceive hot. It's not really hot, temperature-wise, right? But you perceive it. So how is that happening? That chemical binds to that receptor, TRP receptor, and it actually opens it up and allows calcium to go in, like it does with thermal activity. But for some weird reason, the capsaicin activates that TRP receptor also. And it can open it up, and calcium can go in, and then fire that cell. And you perceive that it's hot, right? So what's the other point here? The other point is not just the transduction for the whole system, but where it projects to in the brain, right? And then your cognitive thinking of that sensory perception. So you could take an electrode, go into that part of the brain, and stimulate it, and you would perceive hot, or if you activated a cold spot, you would perceive cold, right? But it's not really cold, it's not really hot out there. So the other point is that these are hardwired kind of systems, right, in you right at present. So if it's hardwired, it goes in there, and then you stimulate that part in your brain, you're going to perceive that kind of stimulus, right? If we put an electrode around your optic nerve and stimulate it total dark, you're going to see all kinds of crazy things, but it's not really there. So if you read some of the general case studies or some fun neurology books, and Oliver Sacks has written a number of these, it's really quite interesting. Think if you had a tumor on your optic nerve, and it was activating, it was causing some abnormal like pressure on it and activating it. What do you think you would see? Or how would you, what would happen?
Hallucinations.
Yeah, hallucinations, visual hallucinations, right? So you would see visual hallucinations, but it's really just a tumor on your optic nerve, right? Or maybe in the back of your head, right? So, you know, we'll talk more about the regions of your brain later. So now you begin to wonder, like that brain on fire, how many people were institutionalized, you know, or maybe those people really did perceive these things. It's real to them, and they're really seeing it, and there's nothing convincing them it's not there, because it really is in their brain, right? Isn't that amazing to think about? And you can kind of put that in the context of society, too, and you wonder about things. But anyways, other things. How about phantom limb pain, right? Somebody loses an arm, but they still feel their fingers. Ideas behind that? Those neurons are still there, right? The endings of those neurons are still there. Sometimes, depending on if they lost their arm or something, those sensory endings, they might die back. They might stay there. And sometimes that scar tissue forms around those nerve endings, and it's called like a neuroma, little swelling, and the connective tissue builds around it, can become very sensitive to them. So you can touch on it, and they're going to think their finger is being touched. Or maybe it's a pain that they actually feel like their hand's on fire. Can you imagine that? And their hand's not there. That's really wild, right? So you think about these cases. So understanding the system and where it projects to, what kind of treatment do you think you might do for somebody like that? Think. Out of the box.
I've heard that they like do the mirror so that way they can like massage the one and it feels like they're doing it.
So you can do psychological experiments, try to get them to think of her, and the idea is a mirror that they have on one side, and then basically you're looking at your, you know, good hand and maybe stroking that, or maybe trying to relax this side, so then psychologically you think, because you're looking at this mirror, you think it's your other hand too, and so you can actually try to reset your brain. Some ideas are actually to go in and actually destroy that part where that perception is, or actually kill out the sensory neurons. And some of the approaches are actually to use capsaicin to kill out pain receptors. So they actually can inject capsaicin. There's a lot of people that are in Korea actually that study capsaicin and pain reception, and a group down in Houston is kind of like the World Center for Pain Reception also. What they have done is actually inject capsaicin into the paws of rodents. You know, if a rodent walks on a hot plate, they feel it's hot, right? They're going to be jumping around. But they start injecting capsaicin over time, and they walk on the hot plate almost until it burns their skin and they don't even feel it. Because the repetitive use of the capsaicin can actually knock out the pain receptors. So you think about, hey, that's pretty cool. We could actually maybe solve these people that have these, you know, problems with that too. So that's kind of neat to think about. And we did mention, I think, before, I don't know if I did or not, the people that have like leg cancer, for example, and you know, a lot of pain in their bone cancer in their leg, and you know, it's very painful and can be really a problem, messing up their life, that they're always in pain. So they actually can go into the spinal cord, if they know the anatomy of the spinal cord, go in and actually transect the pain fibers. So the pain will not go up to their brain, right? You've transected those nerves. The problem in some of those earlier studies that they did, the tracts are very close to the proprioceptive tracts for the leg, your proprioception that we're going to talk about. So sometimes they would make the cut a little too much, and it would cut the proprioceptors, and then you lose your ability to know where your leg is. But it's a way to control pain. So, you know, putting it all together, the neuroanatomy, the physiology, understanding how sensory receptions work, it's really quite cool, isn't it? Yes, maybe? You know, amazing. So that's pretty neat. There was something I was going off on a tangent about. And I forgot what it was. Okay. So lots of things to think about. That'll come back to me. So we want to continue on with understanding about these sensory systems. And actually, the simplest animals opened up a lot of understanding about pain reception. Oh, I know where it was, back on that capsaicin. You can eat the hot peppers, and you probably know some people that can really eat hot peppers. They've probably been eating hot peppers for a long period of time, right? And now they don't respond to it so much. So you wonder about their sensitivity of those pain receptors in their mouth, for example, for that capsaicin. Did they kill them out? Maybe they did. Maybe that's why they're less sensitive.
I know at the beginning you're talking about like why some people are, like in the same room feel hot and some people feel cold. Mm-hmm. Do we ever get back to that completely? So I was just wondering.
Yeah, some of, well, it, you know, I don't know. That'd be really wild. Yeah, I don't know where that is for some people.
Okay.
It might be some of its perception, some of its other factors. Like, you know, you can raise your metabolism up and raise your body temperature too, right? But if you're sitting still, right? So pain is really something really wild. And some people work on pain here at UK. Brad Taylor's lab, right, works on pain. There's a lot of interesting aspects with pain. We had a number of people that worked on pain here. Some have left and some are still here that work on pain reception, so you might ask to work in their labs. There's some people that have the trigeminal pain. You might have heard of these people that just a little puff of air across their face, just like that, is painful. I mean, like excruciating pain, like an ice pick went into their jaw. Phenomenal. Some of the ideas that they came up with is really amazing, and they found out that some of it is the sensory nerve that's next to a blood vessel. And if they actually separate them out, it quits irritating the blood, the sensory nerve. So just putting a sheet in between. I don't know if Brad's doing that work. Is he doing that?
Diabetic
nerve. And so just separating that out caused less irritation of the nerve, and it went away. But, you know, why is it activating that neuron over time caused the pain reception to be more and more and more? That the sensitivity of the sensory ending. So people were studying that about maybe cytokines being released, inflammation causing a, you know, part. So if you have an inflammation, for example, there's something very interesting. I know this is a tangent, but it's so amazing. Somebody that has maybe a C-section and for a baby delivery, and you can touch with these little Van Fry hairs. Neurologists use these. They're like toothbrush bristles. They're little monofilaments, and they're of different thicknesses, okay, and they're different lengths. And they cost you a fortune if you want to buy a whole series. But they're all calibrated, so when you touch and it bends, you know exactly how much force you're giving, right? So different thicknesses, you'd have to give different force. So somebody that might have a burn, for example, in their skin, and they want to know if they're getting sensory perception back, they'll use these Van Fry hairs, and they're all calibrated. But now back to the person that has a C-section, for example, right? And you think, oh, well, they had the C-section or some injury, and for some odd reason, you know, they're a little bit sensitive right after the surgery, right? But you wait 6 months later, all the inflammation's gone, it's all healed up. But you go back and you test around there, they have an increased sensitivity to pain or to touch. Why is that? And they're still trying to figure that out. Why is it after, say, a cut in the skin or activating those sensory neurons, you had more pain? And now they're beginning to think about, if a patient experienced more pain in surgery, for example, they actually experience more pain after surgery. Is that not wild? That's really wild. Because of activity of the nervous system. And when you think about surgeries, anybody's an anesthesiologist or has them in the family, you really wonder about some of the surgeries, right? A long time ago, when I was a student, people boo-hooed the idea that you would lose your memory after surgeries. But people said, oh, I can't remember anything more. The longer the surgery, the longer the anesthetic. They now realize that there are some anesthetics where you actually have amnesia and you actually forget. So you might have heard of people that were in the surgery and then have nightmares of the surgery. And then you wonder, were they really completely under or not, you know? And so there's a lot of relationships now with medications in memory. And they're testing that in mice as well with anesthesia. So it's very interesting about pain. It's not all solved. There's still a lot of research going on in that area and how you perceive pain and why you would increase in pain sensitivity from maybe some kind of experience in the past. Restructuring of the brain is a big thing that goes on with people with, you know, like loss of limb, and they try to rewire, basically causing nerves to branch out and try to rewire their brains. So that's pretty neat too. Whole field out there if you're interested in grad school or grad programs and something of that nature. Neuroplasticity. Okay, so lots of tangents that we went through, but it's so cool. Okay, so mechanoreceptors, chemoreceptors, thermoreceptors, you know, photoreceptors, everything that you can think about with these receptions, and things that we don't think about as humans, electroreceptors and magnoreceptors, right? So you know about birds that can migrate down the South Pole, for example. Was it the magnetic field of the Earth? Things like that. Our electroreceptors, we'll talk about this later too, electric fish, for example, that can put electric field around them and then can detect a change in that electric field. Is pretty amazing that they can do this. And then, like we've been talking about, pain receptors, they're also referred to as nociceptors. So they respond to the damage, like we said, maybe chemosensory actions, like cytokines, can activate those. And they have mechanoreception in there as well. But everybody receives pain differently. Right, so you see the pain scales for people. They show the happy face, the sad face. They ask you where you are, you know. And you say you're in the happy, in the bad face. You know, it's like a 10. With the next person, it would be a 5. So it's all perception. It's hard to put a number to it. I wonder about people that eat hot food all the time, like capsaicin. Would they show a higher pain threshold? You wonder about, you know, things like that, right? It's kind of interesting. Okay, so interoceptors inside the body, like we talked about, homeostasis, pain reception in your gut, for example, blood pressure, temperature in your hypothalamus, your set point, those are kind of interesting too. And proprioception is really important. We're going to do some demonstrations next week in the lab sections with proprioceptors. And then, like we mentioned, there's some really specialized sensory receptors that we're going to talk about in other animals that we're going to hit more about how they live in their environment and evolve in their environment. So pretty neat thing about them. And we already talked about like these optical illusions too. You know, like if you push on your eye, you might see something different, or that, you know, a tumor on your optic nerve. But when you think about some of these perceptions about how animals use them, maybe fool the other animal. It's pretty neat too. And you wonder about even our perception, right? So when you see these images here, some of you see this kind of vase or something, right? And then other people see the outline of the face. You've seen all these kind of things before on the internet. There's tons of these. Or like this, you think that the dot is different, but actually the dot's the same size in both. And then you think about what happens out in the real world with other animals and actually building a nest to make them think that there's a difference or that there's a nest or something that would attract their mate, you know, how they have an altered perception for that, say, mate selection. Pretty neat. Hopefully you've covered some of that in ecology as well. So lots of different things that are really interesting to think about. When we talk about that reception, like we mentioned, the light touch on your skin, right? Some of those receptors can detect that really light touch. But the ones deeper in your skin aren't detecting it, right? So when you push in harder, now you're activating another set. And then you know in your head that that's a deeper touch, right? And you know from light touch to deep touch. But you're probably also activating that light touch one at a higher frequency, right? So the frequency of firing of that neuron is important. And then activating additional ones, you have to integrate that all in your brain. And that's how you then perceive the world about, you know, how deep that touch is, or the direction of movement of that touch is really quite interesting as well. We'll get into a little more of that later. Okay, so when we think about reception, like at the sensory ending, we've talked about this before, right? Touch, mechanosensory, stretch-activated ion channels, right? A graded depolarization, they open up graded, right? Like sodium goes in, maybe some potassium comes up. It depends on that type of receptor, that stretch-activated ion channel, and how big it is, right? And then they get this graded response. Now, we mentioned this a long time ago. Is that graded response, do you want that graded response all the way to go up to your spinal cord? Where's the cell body for your touch receptor down here?
Dorsal
root ganglion next to your spinal cord, right? So you make an action potential early on, send that action potential on up. So your action potential is way down here by the sensory ending. Okay, so you have graded responses. Depends on the type of neuron, but then that graded response might turn into an action potential to then travel to the CNS. Some sensory receptors that are very close to maybe where they need to go to for their target don't need to produce an action potential. A good example of this, very neat study that was done in Marseille, France. They were looking at joint receptors in a crustacean, and they noticed these PERP receptors in a crustacean, like your crayfish, right? You remember your crayfish that tried to pinch you? They have those claws, right? And in those claws, there's a little strand that goes across from the bat claw to the tendon on the inside. And if it moves like that, it stretches or relaxes that little strand. In that little strand are sensory endings. And in that, when you stretch it, it stretches that strand, and those little sensory endings, mechanosensory transduction, they fire. And depending on where they are in that strand, you stretch it differently, then you think animal knows where it is. But it has the cell. What's really interesting about many invertebrates, the majority of animals that is, where the sensory ending is, the cell body is really close to it. So in this case, the cell body is right next to the sensory ending. So you get that graded response, it goes right across the cell body, and boom, it fires an action potential, and that action potential travels up into the animal's ventral nerve cord. So that's kind of neat. But they looked at these proprioceptors that are in the coxal region of their leg, and they found out they have these little strands too when they move their leg around, the little crayfish, and it stretches, you know, so it knows its arm is up or down or anything like that. But that it's a graded response all the way to the ending. Because why? It's such a short distance to the ventral nerve cord, the graded response doesn't die out, and that graded response is good enough to fire the ending, open up the channels, and transmitter release. Graded means non-action potential.
Okay.
And graded could be excitatory or inhibitory. Depends if it's above resting membrane potential or below. So graded is non-action potential, just graded. The more stretch-activated channels, the bigger the graded response, for example. Okay. Good. Everybody's good? Yes.
So you said that, like, since the cell body is near the sensory and then you get the graded response, and then that goes to the cell body and then fires the action?
In like the ones that are far out, right? In the crayfish or the crustacean preparation or the insects.
Okay.
But in some of them, like the ones, the stretch activated channels that are in this proprioceptor close by the ventral nerve cord for that animal, like our spinal cord, it just needs a graded response because it's such a short distance. It doesn't decay as much and it can still cause vesicular release. So it's kind of cool, right? So they work that out and you see, hey, that's pretty neat, you know? All fits together. So these action potentials for long distance transmission, and then we get to the sensory ending. The axon ending where it's actually projecting to, like in the ventral nerve cord of the animal or in the spinal cord, and then you get transmitter release, right? And there's something unique about the transmitter release, right? As we talked about before. but this frequency of action potentials, how many action potentials can you get? How fast of a stimulus can you perceive? Right? You can perceive that, maybe 10 hertz. Can you perceive 20 hertz? Can you perceive 50 hertz? What's your limits? What do you think the limits are due to?
Reset of the neuron,
which is?
Refractory period.
So that makes a big difference here, right? How fast you can perceive your sensory stimulation is limited by the refractory period of that neuron. So that's kind of neat, too. And we can go into a little bit more depth about that later, too. So that's really neat to think about. So there's a lot more to these PowerPoints, and I'm going to go through it, but you have them there to understand the general ideas. So like we talked about, some sensory endings might be just a sensory cell like that that could release transmitter, then activate the next neuron. Or maybe that sensory ending itself, it has a greater response to mix and action potential, but then travel to the brain, for example, or the spinal cord, or the ventral nerve cord of the animal. Okay? And the general process we should know. So like these types of responses are really interesting. So this kind of study was really neat. This is basically a beginning of a understanding one of the sensory receptions in your skin, for example, and it is on standardized exams. A good one is the Purcinian corpuscle. You see this on MCATs and DTAT and all those. So the Purcinian corpuscle is a type of sensory thing that can detect touch on your skin. And it's kind of neat. But this is a little bit different. So I just want you to think about some of the aspects. So if you had a structure around this, let's take an onion, for example. This is a good example. An onion, right? Onion with layers, and the layers are a little loose. All right, we poke a hole in that onion, and we put it around the sensory ending right here, okay? So you push on that onion, what's going to happen? The deformation goes in there, pushes on those different layers, and finally pushes on the ending here. Opens up stretch-activated ion channels, and boom, you can fire an action potential. But over time, those little onion layers move, and it no longer puts the pressure on there. So what's going to happen to those mechanoreceptors? They're going to close, right? But then when you take your finger off the onion, what happens? You've caused another movement around there, and you've pulled on that membrane, and you can fire again. That's the Purcinian corpuscle. That's a standard type of example that's used in MCAT tests and things like that. The point is, if you took away the onion, and they did this in the 1970s to understand Purcinian corpuscles, take away that accessory structure and push directly on the sensory ending, then you could get a great response. And the more you pushed on it, you opened up more stretch-activated channels, and you got a bigger graded response. Some of these graded responses, though, and you can see then what happens if you stay up above threshold for a long time, you fire a higher frequency of action potentials versus not such a much of a graded response, and you fire fewer action potentials. We'll come back to that onion layer in a little bit also, but pretty neat to think about. So you have these kind of phasic and tonic receptors, the type we just talked about with the onion, you would then be phasic, right? Because you sense it pushing on, then you don't sense it anymore, even though you're still stimulating. But then when you come off, you fire it again. So it just fires like an on and off, but not continuously the whole time. If you took away the accessory structure and you push the whole time, you could pretty much get good firing, right? So those are things to think about. And a good example is like this right here. So think about that onion layer that we just talked about. With the onion around there, you would have more of these type of responses. Take the onion away, and you're going to get more of this type of graded response over the whole time, all right? So something to think about with like that Purcinian corpuscle. So the take-home here is that accessory structure can change on how you perceive that environment, right? That accessory structure makes a difference, and it can alter the mechanosensory transduction process.
What is an accessory structure?
That Purcinian corpuscle, for example, the structure that goes around the sensory ending. It's called a Purcinian corpuscle. We'll get to it in just a minute here. But it's a structure that goes around the sensory ending. It's kind of like the strand that we were just talking about in the crustacean legs that when it opens or closes or when it moves any of the joints, there's this elastic strand that goes across there. And there's actually little endings that go around the sensory endings. And it pulls on those sensory endings and makes those neurons fire. We'll go into a little bit more depth about that in a minute. Isn't that just lovely? You just want to sit there and look at it? No? We just stay there the whole next 10 minutes and watch it. Okay, it's just beautiful. Great. Okay, and that's beautiful too, isn't it? Beautiful. There's like 300 different species of crayfish out there. There's a whole book of crayfish of Kentucky if you're really interested. All right. But there's some really interesting ones in Kentucky. There's a one over by Richmond, just to kind of get you thinking about it in the natural environment. There's a crayfish that lives over in Richmond, Kentucky, that only lives in Richmond, Kentucky. It's the only one in the world, only species in the world, right over in Richmond, Kentucky. It lives underground most of the year. Only when it rains, like you know, we had the other day, does it really come out of the ground. So it's endemic to that area. There's a guy that used to be there. He retired now, Gunther Schuster. He's like a world expert on crayfish. He was right there in Eastern Kentucky. Eastern Kentucky actually has a museum. Anybody from Eastern Kentucky been down there? Did you ever see the museum in the biology building? All right, there's a museum of mussels and fish and of crayfish. And so you can actually go down there and see. It's one of the state museums, actually. That's out of the state. It's in the biology building. So he's collected crayfish all around Kentucky and different parts of the world. And this one crayfish in Richmond actually lives underground in a burrow system. And they're wondering, it only comes out when it rains, really. So how does it survive? How does it reproduce? So Gunther, like most faculty, are a little wacko, right? So he actually built a whole system in his basement. He built like a big ant farm in his basement. And he built this with this plexiglass and glass and put all the mud in there, and then he put his crayfish in there from Richmond, Kentucky, so he could see the tunnels that they would build, and they would interact in their tunnels underneath the ground, so you never know what was going on, just like little ants in their little ant hut. So he actually figured out a whole new behavior that crayfish have underground in interaction. But think, it's dark, right? They then might have a different sensory perception. Maybe their tenor are more sensitive. Maybe their chemosensory to pheromones is different. That's pretty neat. We actually have a crayfish in Kentucky too that lives in the Kentucky River, only in the Kentucky River, nowhere else in the world, called the bottle brush crayfish, because its antennae have these, looks like a bottle brush. It has all these little hairs that stick out of it, and it gets algae on it, and it looks like a bottle brush. And you wonder, is it more sensitive to tactile sense compared to other animals? You've got something really unique in Kentucky down at Mammoth Cave. Down deep in the Mammoth Cave. What do you think of those crayfish? They're blind cave crayfish. And you've got some that are endemic to Mammoth Cave only. You can't really work on them. The federal government put those as endangered species. There's a cave in Louisville that's right downtown Louisville where there's a cave crayfish that lives in Louisville that's only endemic to that one cave in Louisville. There's nowhere else in the world. It's an isolated species. It's probably going to die out. It's going to go extinct in time because of pollution. But it doesn't have any eyes. So what do you think about its sensory perception now? Does it have an enhanced sensory perception, do you think? Of chemo? Tactile, maybe? Maybe it's more, you know, sensitive. Now you think about blind people that are maybe blind from birth. Are they maybe tuning in to hearing better? Does their hearing work better? Are they more sensitive to olfaction, more sensitive to touch? What do you think? Right? You've heard about cases like that. Anybody ever hear of Echo Boy? No? Echo Boy? It was in the news there a while back in California.
Clicks.
He would click. And he could actually kind of like get an echo off of things. And people wondered, is it really true? You know, so he was working with blind. He could ride his bike down the street and click and actually know not to hit a car, for example, that's parked. People thought it was crazy. He's making this up. Maybe he can really see. So physicians worked on him and actually tested, and he could actually perceive this kind of stuff. So he would actually, like a bat, echolation. And so he actually teaches other blind people to actually try to perceive this a little bit better. Now, maybe he's a little extra sensitive in that, you know, side. You never know. But it's actually been debunked. It's not a fake story. It's real that this guy can actually perceive these kind of things. So it's really quite interesting. So you wonder then about these cave crayfish, right? Do they have an extrasensory perception? Is it integrating in their brain, or do they actually have more receptors on the endings, right? So where is it? Where's the difference? Is it the primary sensory reception? You know, more chemosensory receptors? Or is it more in the brain perceiving that information? And this is things to think about. So people look at this for human studies, right? It's very important to try to figure that out. Beautiful, beautiful critter. But anyways, what we're using this animal for is the part about talking about proprioception. So in their backs right here, they know where their tail is. And if you cut them open, right, and you pinched on their tail when you're trying to pin it out and do your resting membrane potential, it might have tail flipped on you, right? Amazing, because the sensory neurons are still functioning in the tail. But in the back of this animal, on each segment, there are these two little muscle fibers. And it's really quite amazing. And this is the work on it. So let me diverge here for a second, because you know me. Can't resist. All right, so we're going to come back to figures. So in the crayfish tail, if we look at the segments, we're looking down on the top of the crayfish now. Okay, we're looking down at the top. There are the midline. Okay, off the midline, off the back of the crayfish, there are two little muscle fibers. Very small. Two little muscle fibers that span that segment. Okay, you get the idea? Span the segment. On those two muscle fibers, just single cells, there's a sensory ending to a cell, to a neuron. And the cell body is right by the sensory ending, like many invertebrate sensory neurons. And then the other muscle fiber has another sensory neuron associated with it. And it has a cell body right there, and an axon. Then the axon goes to the ventral nerve cord, and then it can fire when it's stretched. So let's call this A and B. Really amazing. So let's take this, like in that picture we showed earlier, let's take this out and let's stretch this and pin this down. So we're going to pin this side down and we're going to stretch this. We're going to record from A and B. We're going to put a hook electrode on A or a hook electrode on B, and we're going to record from them separately. All right, so we're going to, first let's do the stimulus. So here's the stimulus. We're going to stretch. So we're going to stretch and hold it. So this is stretch. And we're going to record from A. And what we're going to see is this is the axon. This is extracellular. So these are called spikes, right? Extracellular recording of the nerve are referred to as spikes. They're produced from action potentials that travel down the nerve. All right, so these are spikes. And A fires when you stretch it. And since there's only one neuron, then there's only one size spikes. B will fire when you stretch, but it fires throughout the whole stretch. Wow. Wild, right? Same stimulus, two different neurons. One fires the whole time, and the other one stops after you end the stretch. Well, let's try something different. This time, let's stretch to a much stronger stretch. Okay? So now we're giving a much larger stretch to it, the same rate. Well, what you find out is that if this is going for the same amount of time, you get the same pretty much activity if it's the same rate. But then since you stretched it more, this firing rate is at a higher rate now. The tonic one now fires at a higher rate because you stretched it more. It's kind of like what we talked about with that sensory ending as you pushed on it more. Now what's really cool is you change the rate that you stretch these at. Maybe to the same level. A neuron now fires at a lower firing frequency. But if you move that rate faster and go to the same level, it will fire at a higher firing frequency. What's the take-home here? The take-home is they're rate-dependent. It can tell at what rate that abdomen's moving, at what rate you move your arm out, right? At what rate am I moving it slow? Am I moving it fast, right? And then how far did you move it? Did you move it a little bit, or did you move it all the way out, right? It's no different than your arm, like that analogy. Okay, so that's pretty cool. It's got these two muscle fibers. What if, though, how does this fit to you? Well, let's turn this around. Now let's draw your muscles. So here's your arm muscle. Okay, I don't know how it works here. Let's just draw this muscle like this. Your bicep, for example, in your arm. All right? Your big muscle is innervated by an alpha motor neuron, right? It innervates, makes that muscle contract. But how do you know that your muscle, when you close your eyes, you know your arm has moved, right? So how do you know your muscles contract? Is it a joint receptor? What do you think? How many might think it's a joint receptor? Something in the muscle? Maybe it's all in the brain. When you fire the motor neuron, you know how much you fire it, you perceive it, that you know you're going to move it that far.
Doesn't something innervate muscle fibers so that when it like contracts, the thickness is bigger, so it has to stretch the like spindle around it? Or am I thinking it's
Yeah,
like...
that's right. We're on the right thing. There are your extrafusal muscle is your big muscle. Your intrafusal muscle are these little sacs. Little sacs that you have spread out on your muscle. Not too many of them. A few of them. Right? So they're like these little packs. Now let's expand those little packs. If we expand that little pack, it looks something like this. I'm going to turn it sideways. Or here's this one. So it looks something like this. It's a little capsule. And it's called a little capsule. And if you look inside that capsule, guess what's inside that capsule? Two little muscle fibers. Okay? One's called a nuclear chain because it looks like a chain. And one's called a nuclear bag because it has this bag shape to it. And like you said, there's actually sensory endings around these two muscle fibers. This sensory ending's around that one. This sensory ending's around this one, pretty much, in general. There's some little differences, but the main take-home here is like this. Guess what? Let's do an experiment. Let's stretch this. Let's pin this side down. Let's stretch it. Let's call that A. Let's call this one B and this one A. The bag A and the chain B. And we stretch it and hold it. And if we record from A, guess what we get? And if we record from B, guess what we get? Wow. Is that not cool? That's really cool. Because what is it like? No different than the crayfish preparation, which we call a muscle receptor organ. In many comparative physiology classes, you would be recording from the muscle receptor organ with a suction electrode over that nerve. On that prep you did for the intracellular recordings and potassium stuff, there was a nerve to the side. And many times you just pull that up in a suction electrode and bend the abdomen. We do this in the neurophys class, and you can record these spikes. It's really quite cool. But what happens, here's the take home that's really kind of odd. So you stretched it. If I stretch it out, I stretch the bicep. I stretch these little intrafusal muscles. Those are called intrafusal fibers. Extrafusal is your big muscle. Intrafusal, that little capsule in those two muscle fibers. And if I stretch that, but then if I go this direction, what happens to that little capsule? It becomes flaccid, right? So how do I know if I relax it a little bit more? How do you keep the detection? Well, you have another muscle, the antagonist, right, that got stretched. That's one way. But there's something very unique about those little muscle fibers. They have motor neurons innervating them. They have a motor neuron that innervates these muscle fibers. So when it becomes flaccid, that motor neuron's firing and it keeps it taut. These are called your gamma motor neurons. Okay, gamma motor neurons. The motor neurons to your big muscle, your extrafusal muscle, is called alpha motor neurons. Alpha. Okay, so that's kind of neat to think about. What about the crayfish? Let's turn that around, back around to the crayfish prep. Well, what if that abdomen now isn't stretched anymore and it's back where it's kind of flaccid? How can it detect if it's more flaccid or not, you know, stretched enough? Guess what? It has motor neurons too. It has a motor neuron that innervates these muscle fibers. And it's no different than the way your muscle spindles work. Stephen Kuffler, 1960s, worked on this. The guy that I told you was chair of Harvard Neurobiology, he worked on this, but also Eckert, which some of you might have the Eckert textbook, that's what he did in the 1960s. he recorded from these muscle spindle organs. And this then opened up the field about what? About how your muscles detect proprioception. Because your muscles, those proprioceptors, are so small, they're hard to record from. But in the crayfish, they're really easy to record from. So understanding those basic principles of proprioception, thank you, crayfish, right? So it's really quite amazing what was going on. But not only that, the crayfish preparation is a little bit unique and even more interesting than the human one in the sense that they actually have an inhibitor motor neuron that goes right to the muscle fiber too. They have exciters and an inhibitor that goes to these fibers. So that's a little bit more interesting. That's pretty cool, right? Isn't that cool? That's really cool. Okay, so if we go back to this, you're just like a little crayfish. All right. And I know we're going to stop in a second, but I just want to show you this. So these are these crayfish preparations, right? Tonic, phasic, no different than your muscle spindles in you, right? Very interesting. There's a nuclear bag, there's a nuclear chain, and the sensory endings that come off of that. Okay? And, you know, stretch, stretch. So we're just like a little crayfish. Take that home. Think about that. All right? And so see some of you tomorrow morning, bright and early, right? We're starting at 8 or 9.
9,
okay.
Yeah, 9.
But what's your warning Monday class to Wednesday class? Hand exercises, right? They need hand exercises, you know? All right, good. All right.
What if my hand cramps during the exam?
It's okay, just massage it.
Miss Holsinger.
Oh, how long?
Like, how did you all meet each other?
I knew.